This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, sir.
Hello.
Welcome to our podcast.
What is deep breathing thing we're doing? Chris did the biggest thing. He's like, hello.
Hello.
In a world. What's new with y'all this week?
Still trash.
Waiting for RailsCon.
Yeah, the Suns lost this week. Did the Grizzlies win?
Okay. So we won Tuesday night, and then we played the Timberwolves last night, and we were down 26 points.
Ooh.
Yeah. By halftime, it was like within 6 or 8. And I was like, okay, that's some basketball.
Next season?
Third quarter, down 25. I turned it off. Shannon texted me because she was in the car listening to it and said, don't wake the kids up. It was within 3 points. And then by the end of the game, the Grizzlies won by like 10 points. It was
nine.
The Timberwolves blew 2 25-point-plus leads in a game.
Wow.
This is a roller coaster.
Our fan of the Timberwolves, I hope he's not listening.
He messaged me last night, Andrew. That's a roller coaster of a game. But I did tell Andrew Mason that if for some reason the Grizzlies make it to play the Suns, I will fly out to Phoenix and we'll go to a game together.
I would literally love that. So I'm kind of.
I told Shannon that last night and she said, how? With money. That's how.
With our NFT money, dude.
Well, you apparently won't buy the gas, whatever the hell that means.
Dude, there's like $100 gas fee.
You don't think our NFT is worth that?
No. I was literally going to sell it for like $5 USD worth of ETH. So I was like, I'm not paying $100 to list this. I'll wait for the gas to go down. It fluctuates.
I feel like my dad. I don't know anything you're talking about. I assume ETH is some crypto.
Yes, Ethereum. The money form is called Ether. I realized that I actually remember a lot more about this than I thought I did from my Web3 days at CodeFund. Because I started like looking it up again. And I was like, oh, wow, this isn't that hard. But then I got bored and stopped.
What were y'all doing Web3 wise at CodeFund?
We were working on bringing decentralized non-tracking advertisements to Web3. We were trying to be the first, I think, to bring like a new age of advertising, one that doesn't focus on who you are versus what you're interested in. As in terms of the content that you're consuming, like you go on a Ruby website, you probably want to see advertising start Ruby conferences. You don't want to see that like you are actually looking up baby formula and they're showing you like baby ads or whatever. So that kind of thing. But didn't work out. Oh my God. My heart just sank. You just put me into fight or flight.
I didn't know where to go with it. So I just bailed.
We got to go somewhere else quick. Chris, you did some cool stuff this week, it sounds like.
Yeah, a little bit. Every website getting a command palette these days, every application too. Thought that would be a nice one to add. So a long time ago, I found a Ninja Keys little repository that's open source. It's a JavaScript library, but it initializes a custom element web component. And then you add that to your page and then you write a script tag that will go find the element and then just add data to it, which is an array of commands and their icons and their names and stuff. So it works really well. And you can wire that up really nicely with Stimulus, but it's built on top of web components and Hotkeys.js. So I tried it out and it worked on the first page you're on, but not the second page. And I was like, oh, this is strange. And that's because the Hotkeys got registered and there was the setup callback for the web component, but there was no like disconnect callback. So I ended up forking it and adding that in so that it cleans up safely with any web framework or JavaScript framework. And so it works nicely with Turbo now. The guy merged my PR and released a new version of it. So you can like use that anywhere, but I dumped that in Jumpstart Pro and have some examples where you can type notifications and it will take you right to that page. But you can also run, it's just a JavaScript callback. So you just say, hey, whenever this gets selected, do whatever you want. And I'd like to probably for like a screencast and some other stuff, like I want to go and see about adding in maybe like a search or something, being able to show your results, search results maybe. I'm not sure if that's like a feature it actually supports yet though. So we will see, but it's all written in Lit Element. Have either of you heard of that?
I have both heard of it and been lit myself.
I think I've gotten lit once before.
Bet.
I mean, more than once.
That is the biggest gamble I will take. Yeah. Confident in that.
We've reached our limit. We found the line.
Our litmus.
Lit is really nice. I was like, wow, it's kind of like a new way of thinking and I kind of like it.
Yeah, it's really cool to think about like writing more complex stuff in web components, and Stimulus is kind of just cherries on top of the functionality connecting existing stuff. But if you like Turbo Streams or Turbo Frames, like have internal logic for the elements themselves, and like it's a great way to just go build your own element with its own concepts and slots. For example, like you can add a footer to Ninja Keys and it's just like, oh, inside that Ninja Keys element, we'll put a little div and say, or whatever, that it's the footer slot, and voila, pops right in where it belongs and you're good to go. So it's a pretty cool little tool.
Is this your first time using web components in like any kind of thing you've shipped?
Well, does Hotwire's Turbo Frames and stuff count?
Nope.
Then no, I don't think I've used...
We both just said no.
I don't think I've really used that much myself, because most of the time it would just be like a stimulus controller or something. Well, no, I take that back. Vime.js is player, and it's written in web components too. There's elements inside of it, but you don't see them in your HTML. That part to me feels strange.
The appeal of web components is there for me. I understand their value and I want to use them. And I honestly, God, don't know why I haven't, because like,
yeah,
we have all these other abstractions for components, React and Vue and Vue component. And this is one made for the DOM, which is where all these other components end up.
Right. Yeah. It's like you're inside the element itself and working in that context, instead of you're on the outside creating an element or a component that is comprised of stuff. And it is very similar to writing a Vue component or React or something, but it's got its own CSS stuff and its own like DOM internally that you can see in the browser. But when you write it in your HTML, it's just like a one-liner, really simple. Mm-hmm. It's neat. And I think it's a little bit tougher to like style or whatever, because you got to go effectively look and find out you're styling this element, and then it might have Ninja Keys has like CSS variables to go style the icon size, for example. Because you're not really seeing those things, it can be a little bit trickier to use as a someone who's like familiar with styling CSS normal. You're not going to necessarily see all those like sub elements inside of it when you're doing your development, but you will in the browser. So you can kind of go through that. It's pretty cool. And it's supported by all modern browsers. Andrew was saying before we recorded that like Connor's working on that at Microsoft. So the big companies are investing a lot into it. I know GitHub has.
It would be cool if maybe we could talk to Connor about that one day on Remote Ruby.
Yeah, Connor.
Cough,
yeah,
cough.
Connor.
Cough.
This is an official call out. Have you guys looked at shoelace style?
Shoelace is actually what I was thinking of when you said lit. I am so ignorant. Holy hell. Yes, yeah. I'm familiar with shoelace. I've heard of lit, but now I'm with you.
Just for everyone out there listening, Jason's literally one of the smartest people I've ever met. So don't let him gaslight you.
Oh my God, you love that term. You love to gaslight me into believing I love that term.
I originally got introduced to web components because Jared White created a quick search plugin for Bridgetown that literally you could just install and it gave you complete search functionality across your entire blog. And it is built with a web component. And that's when I first got into it. And then Connor started getting me into it more and more. I found Shoelace and I was like, this is really cool. And this really matches the way I like to develop of building really small components and like shipping those separately and just being very atomic and good at doing one thing and then leveraging the power of CSS variables and stuff to like take it to a different level. Although I want to know what y'all think about CSS variables because I like them, but I see way too many people trying to recreate their SAS setup with it.
Yeah, I could see that.
I've never used them because they scare me.
Do you still round your corners with using images?
And oh, hell yeah.
An absolute.
Yeah.
Just uses the center element, dude.
I don't know. I like them because, you know, if you want to go change stuff in Tailwind or whatever, like it makes it really easy to swap in a variable and change stuff. Or like, for example, if you're building Podia and you want your really customizable customer versions of the site, changing the background color or whatever, like drop in those variables at the top of the page and boom. And you don't have to rewrite your CSS or anything for each user or whatever, which is sweet. So I think they're really cool. I think there's probably a little additional things that people would love to see, like lighten and darken the color by 50% or whatever, being able to transform that and say like, you know, you give us your base color and we'll generate text 100, 200, 300, 400, and so on. That'd be sweet. But also like probably to the designers out there, they want to specifically choose those colors, not just auto-generate those.
I will say, if you want to see some really interesting use of CSS variables, the Obsidian themes, I'll use them. And
here we go.
No, I'm not going there. I was going to ask y'all, did y'all see the unofficial draft for CSS toggles?
I saw something about it and I think it's already slipped my mind what it all was. Educate us.
Literally, I click a button and it toggles. Here, I'll drop a link in the show notes.
Wow.
Whoa.
Hold on. I'll drop a code pen. If you guys look at this code pen and listeners, as long as you're not driving, this code pen will be in the show notes. And it's literally like you click on a button and there's an emoji on it. And whenever you click the button, it toggles from a dark moon to a light moon. And it's only CSS.
Interesting.
So you have to define this toggle root, and that is what is, I guess it just needs to be on a parent element of some sort, probably any parent, not necessarily right. HTML toggle trigger. So I wonder if they're going to have like same things for like the toggle, or no, I guess it's just when it's toggled, you have your own selector for it. And then the base one's just the default, but it's not toggle.
Yes, I think so. Toggle root can host more than one toggle. A toggle can have more than one active state. So it's not only 0 and 1, which is exactly what I want from a Boolean, but that's cool. We don't have to go there. The states don't need to be numbers, but can also be words. The initial toggle state is 0 by default, but you can override it. An element can both be the toggle root and the toggle trigger. In the case, use the toggle property, which is shorthand. Scope of a toggle value can be narrowed down to a descendant elements only. Toggle visibility allows you to show and hide an element based on the value. It's kind of like a details and summary element. And the benefit to using toggle visibility is that contents of the element are always available to the UA for in-page find and stuff like that. And toggles can be grouped using toggle group, where you can use like tabs, and sticky toggles cannot become inactive. There will always be one item active, and state machines with transitions are being discussed. This is all very experimental, I should say, before anyone gets super excited.
Yeah, it's cool though. Like Javon was saying, toggles are such a core thing you end up writing any JavaScript for. Makes a lot of sense. There's so many things that I think people need to use that detail summary element a whole lot more. That is not used enough. And then this would make so many things. Toggling a dropdown anywhere in a nav bar or anything That would be awesome.
Yeah. So I linked another demo link, and this one is actually a much cooler representation of what it can do, because you can click on the button and it changes the color scheme. So it toggles from dark mode to light mode.
Yeah. That's so cool. Because otherwise, you got to write a listener that adds a class somewhere and turns on dark mode on the body or whatever. This is way cleaner.
And it even has a state machine at the bottom, which I'm not going to explain on the podcast because it's a little more complex, but this is really interesting. Basically, yeah, like establishing when you initialize a certain toggle, you can set states that like it can proceed to, basically. Very interesting.
That's really fascinating. I wonder how you could use that with Ajax request to just automatically have an element, and then when it fails, you just have to change the state of the element.
Yeah. Oh my God, that would be so nice.
Instead of finding the element, changing the class, you'd just be like, oh, this element is in a rejected state, or a failed state, or a success state.
Right.
Or a pending state while it's in the middle. Oh, that's...
Yeah, that's...
Big brain.
There is a polyfill, but they say all over the place, this is a draft spec.
You talked all the way through that.
Yeah, I know, but it's cool. It's like the coolest thing I've seen like all week.
It's really cool. It's a lot better than you initially described it.
Thank you.
Yeah, the
auto buzz and does thing.
Yeah, it's one of those where you're looking at it and you're like, okay, real simple. But then when you start to realize just how many applications that has, that's going to be real exciting.
Yeah. And nesting is also potentially coming out in the future soon. Native nesting.
Oh, so, wow.
There's a lot coming out in CSS recently.
Wow. Nesting in CSS is exciting. Dang. Yeah. Because that's like literally the only feature I really wanted in SAS or anything like that.
Yep.
That's all I really wanted.
I feel that these things are exciting, but it's hard for me to get excited about things because they move so slowly, understandably. But
that's why we have Babel. You know, you can use the future JavaScript and it's so easy and everything's not complicated or millions of dependencies, right?
Right.
No comment.
Well, Andrew, thanks for toggling our minds about the CSS feature.
Yeah, seems to be a bright future. I mean, aspect ratio has come out. We've got things like min, max, and line clamp, and lots of new text decoration stuff. CSS is moving forward. Safari just made a bunch of stuff available, like flex gap, which was missing for a while. So things are happening.
Yeah, the gap utilities in Tailwind are some of my favorite. I've started writing forms, and with a Rails form, you can't use gap on it or like space X. Yeah, space X or space Y. I'm getting my X and Y's confused because the first element in a Rails form is the CSRF token. And so that gets included. But if you wrap everything inside the form in a div and just say like space Y six, everything just lines up beautifully.
I think there's a way to skip the first one.
Maybe.
I think so. I'll have to find it for you.
But I think it's cool. I think these kind of CSS things make, no matter if you're using like utility classes or pure CSS, I think it makes things simpler, not having to wrap each element in some kind of like PY3. So it has padding top and bottom 12 rim or whatever. So we're getting there. I think by the time I'm 50, CSS will be where I want it. And that's, how far away is that? Oh, damn. Okay, 18 years.
18 years. That's a song. I don't remember the rest of the lyrics, but...
Isn't it soon to be 17 years?
Our collective birthdays are coming up.
Yep.
When is your birthday?
Sure is.
Chris, is yours May 25th?
Mm-hmm.
Mine's May 30th. You're 5 days apart.
So close. And it's just after RailsConf. We can party at RailsConf.
So hard.
Have a birthday party.
You said Chris is the 25th and Jason's the 30th?
No, the other way around.
Really? Am I going to listen to this episode back?
I would like to hear a little more before we move on about the command palette stuff that you put in a Jumpstart. From a user of Jumpstart, what is it like to implement it?
You just use Jumpstart, which is awesome. It works out of the box. So basically, it's included in the layout at the bottom, and your stimulus controller mounts to it. So it's basically real simple. Ninja keys and data controller command palette on there. And then the stimulus controller defines an array of different objects. And they say like what name it should be displayed for it and what icon. And then you have a callback and you can like nest things. So one of the examples in Ninja keys was like switching from dark mode to light mode and having sub commands. So you could search like theme and then hit that, which would replace the options with the sub options. And then you could select those. So yeah, for the most part, it is add a new entry, define whatever you want in there. I'm trying to think of a good example, like support maybe, and you would add an icon, grab the heroicons, drop in the SVG for it, add the like ninja icon or whatever class it is to it. So it's the right size. And then you write a little JavaScript callback. All of mine right now are just turbo.visit/notifications. And you hit enter and it will call the function and then call turbo visit. And that's it. So you could do anything you want from there. It'll all be on the JavaScript side, obviously. But I would like to go a little bit further and set up conditional things as examples. Maybe you're using Jumpstart Pro and you don't have billing enabled. So we should conditionally include billing in there, which we could use with effectively a stimulus value that's like billing is true, and add the billing link in there or whatever else you might want. I'd also like to see an integration like in GoRails. We'll put it in GoRails and then Command K and you could search for like an episode or something. It'd be kind of cool to do that. I don't know if that will exactly work the way... It depends. I was going to go look at like GitHub and see how their command palettes and things work. Because maybe for search, it actually just toggles the focus on the search box or something. I wasn't entirely sure like how some of those integrations might work for different applications. Because, you know, like the Algolia search thing is kind of like a command palette where it pops up as a modal, but it's just really search. It's not commands. So there's kind of a fine line between all these different options, and I haven't fully explored all of those, but for the most part, I'm using it as a power user, quick navigation thing, and it works tremendously fast because you hit enter and then Turbo's already loading the new page and it's just there all of a sudden. It's so fast.
That's awesome. I love that. The library using Ninja keys.
Yep.
How'd you find that?
I saw it on Hacker News or something, and then it came up like a bunch of times in our GoRails Discord too. I keep asking because I'd leave it in a tab as like a to-do that I'm going to come back and implement this. And then I'd lose the tab or something, ask about it again. And then I finally tried it and it didn't work because when it would navigate between pages, Hotkeys.js would have registered with that old element that has been now deleted from the DOM by Turbo. So the hotkey was still registered, but it couldn't find the element anymore. And so it just stopped working. So that cleanup allows you to like re-register those hotkeys every time the page changes accordingly. Rather, the individual element can be added and removed anytime and the hotkeys go with it, which is nice.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Ninja keys would have been a great name for a piano course for ninjas.
Yeah. You're going to start that on Podia?
I am. I'm going to. That and my testing book I wrote.
You got your keyboard right behind you.
My fingers aren't ninja fast, though.
They are ninja fast, technically, the second you put on a ninja costume. So,
luckily, I have my old Power Ranger costume from when I was four. My mom saved.
I like that still gets usage.
My Power Ranger costume.
Yes.
Yeah, so
Jaden running around in that is hilarious.
I think I told you this, but my mom saves the most amazing things, like a McDonald's bath toy that I used to play with. My kids now have, and I was like, Oh, I used to have that. And Shannon's like, yeah, your mom saved it. And I was like, what the f-? So, I'm going to link to my testing book. It's a four-page testing book I wrote.
Yeah. I did tell you that you needed to make sure you publish that.
I read it. It was the first book I've read all the way through in a long time, Dave.
Cover to cover.
Literally, I was enthralled every single page. So, yeah, you have to drop it.
Drop it in that show note.
It's lit.
Shoelace.
It's got a very official URL too. jasoncharns.com/test.pdf. How can it get more official?
The official testing guide of all of Ruby.
All of software engineering, really.
Yeah, true. This does apply to most languages, I would think.
Bet.
We got another one.
We've created a monster.
We have created a cult. Whether US East 1 is down or you forgot to add a configuration file, everyone has an outage from time to time. When your next outage occurs, transparency is critical. The difference between a minor annoyance that people soon forget and a fiasco that creates sustained resentment is in how you communicate. That's why you need Honey Badger. Honey Badger will be a crucial component of your incident response plan with their uptime monitoring service that now has an exciting new feature, public status pages. Create a new status page with custom domains, branding, and more. Don't let Twitter be the only way your users can find out if your app is down. Sign up for Honey Badger to improve your incident response with a shiny new status page that you will be proud to show your users. Visit honeybadger.io and start giving your users a better experience today and let them know Remote Ruby sent you. Thanks to Honey Badger for their continued support of Remote Ruby.
Well, speaking of cults, you had a product idea. You wanted to pitch.
Product idea.
For some Kool-Aid. Everybody needs to drink it.
Let's go. I'm thirsty.
I was just kind of mulling this idea over. And when we were thinking about show topics, I was like, it might be kind of fun to like talk about how one would even start to like plan a product. Because like, I've never built a product from start to finish. I have failed halfway to 80% through many times. But because Chris does it all the time, I'm like, what is like the thinking process?
Hold on, because Chris ships products all the times or Chris fails all the time? You weren't very clear there.
Sorry. Chris ships all the times. Ships all the time.
Both.
Sorry. So I like to watch videos on YouTube that are educational or informational in nature. And I want to take notes
about cats.
About cats, which can it be about dogs?
No, it's about cats. History of Cats, the musical.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know anything about the musical other than James Corden was in the movie.
You should watch some informational YouTube videos on it.
No. I'm talking about different things. I want to take notes on basically what is being said. And I want to take kind of like time-stamped notes. And there's really no good way to do this. And there's a few products out there, but they all really suck. So basically what I want is that while I'm watching YouTube, either I can open the YouTube video in another application or there's a bookmark extension or something where as the video is happening, I want to be able to basically hit a button and take a quick capture note of, oh, this is really interesting. This reminds me of like blah, blah, blah. Or this is related to like this Alfred workflow I was working on, or this is related to this. And basically at the end of the video, I would like a note with the title of the video, some metadata about it, and basically my notes formatted as Markdown that are timestamped to that point in the YouTube video so that when I'm going back, I don't have to scroll and rewind to figure out where something was said. I can just click on the timestamp, go straight to it, share it with other people, et cetera, et cetera.
There was a course, I want to say it was maybe like in a Phoenix course that did something similar. That's what you build in the course. I want to say maybe it's the Programming Phoenix book. That's actually the example they give.
So I have to learn Elixir.
That's the only way you can do this.
Yeah, that's the only way to build that specific product.
That or Laravel. Any of those two will guide you there.
I would probably do it in Phoenix.
Bet.
I started learning Phoenix at one point. Well, if that's
true. Is that because you live there?
No, but it is now, baby. Let's go, Phoenix. I'll have to check that out. That's interesting. But that's my idea. But I'm like, okay, so where would I even start?
Yeah.
I obviously have some ideas where I'd start, but I'm like, where would you start?
first of all, like, what does it look like? Like, how do you interact with this thing? The most seamless thing would probably be a browser extension. You could build your own thing where you have to paste in the YouTube URL or whatever. And that might be not a bad idea in some use cases or whatever. But in theory, you want this to be there when you're already on YouTube. And then you think about it, not having to be like, oh, I'm watching this video. I want to make a note. I got to copy the URL and whatever. I oftentimes think about that, like, user experience from that perspective. So then that would tell me, like, okay, we should build a browser extension. And then you will want to figure out first, what browsers do you want to support? Probably just pick one, like Chrome or whatever might be the easiest. Yeah. I would go for, like, whatever you use day to day, because that's what you'll want to use it first. And then, like, figure out, how do those work? Because I know that they're a little special because they have some security around them and whatnot, but they can be allowed to access the page. You can figure out, like, all the YouTube videos, they have a title, and you figure out your selectors for those, auto grab that stuff, and then maybe even insert your own stuff onto the page. Like, if you've ever used Loom, Loom will go add a video record button next to your GitHub comments and Gmail and everywhere around the web. And it's a really great extension for quick access like that. So maybe you do that. Maybe you add a little button and inject it into any YouTube page like that. And then you start building your backend. Your front end should be pretty straightforward. You should be able to query for the video title. You can query for, like, the ID, the current timestamp. You can have that when maybe you click the button, it grabs the current timestamp, adds it as a hidden field into the form. You write your markdown comments, and when you submit it, makes an API request to your Phoenix app, your Laravel app. I don't know. That's the hardest decision there.
Just Node at this point. Might as well.
So, interesting question. Maybe it's not interesting to you, but me. Do you pause the video when you hit the button so you can finish the note and submit it? Or do you let the video keep playing? Because then what if you need to, like, you don't finish
the time? I'd pick one, use it, then see if it's a pain in the butt where you're like, actually, I don't want to stop. I'm still listening. I'm just typing and I don't want to, like, interrupt. But that makes for, like, one of those really good times to say, like, let's try it. And then it probably just needs to be a setting in the extension or whatever, and then you can start kind of mapping out those extra features as you use it. You're like, okay, we should set a cookie or whatever, you know, setting in local storage to denote, like, do we pause when you click that button or do we let it go? Because the other piece of that too is now you got to probably interact with the YouTube API, the JavaScript API or the iframe or whatever they're running on there in order to click the pause. Either you could probably simulate a click on the pause button if you can find it, or interact with their JavaScript.
Surely someone has some kind of, like, JS library for interacting with that.
It's actually quite hard to interact with YouTube, apparently.
So GoRails has an integration with, I don't remember, I think we use iframes for the video, but they have both if you embed with JavaScript or the iframe. They have official APIs for integrating on your own site as an embed. It's almost certainly going to be different on YouTube itself. Because I think last time I was poking around YouTube in the HTML, like, they have a lot of custom elements for stuff all over, like YT-whatever. So maybe it is trickier to do it on the site itself, but probably doable, pretty reasonable. But then, yeah, you start to get to thinking about, like, okay, how does this work on the back end, right? So are these notes, do I create projects or do I create teams? Is there ever going to be a need to share this with other people? And that's one of the, like, major reasons why Jumpstart has accounts out of the box. And we have two types of accounts, like personal and team accounts, so that you can associate these notes with an account, and then the account can have other users on it. So you could share with other people and not have to set up any sharing functionality or teams or anything yourself. Just associate it with the account, not the user, because the account's the one that provides the association between multiple users. So even if it's only one user, just use the account anyways. so that they're always treated the same regardless, which is, you know, what GitHub would have done probably. But I know that their organizations are kind of like, or wrapper around users, like an organization on GitHub was like a user at some point that was just kind of, oh, we need to add these, so let's just hack them in, and weren't fully thought out like at the time. And it's just kind of, I've heard several GitHub people talk about that, how it's kind of just stuck around and it was based on the user. But had you planned it out earlier, it would be much cleaner to manage. Then, yeah, you kind of go through that and figure out like, how do I surface the notes? You'll probably want to show them when you're viewing that video. You come back to it a year later and you want to have a list of your notes there. You also probably want to have them on your own website so you can go straight to whatever your app's name is and manage those and see them, organize them by video, that sort of thing. And your payments and whatever else that you might want to do, if you want to charge for this, then it could be, we put billing on the account so that it's just GitHub and Heroku and everything else. You can have a team account. It could be charged for differently per user, or it's a personal account and it's just charged by the user or one person individually, and do your billing separately, especially with Teams, because it gets to be a mess if you don't do that.
And charge per second of video watched.
Yeah. There you go.
I hope it's clear that was a joke.
What I have thought about,
I was like, furiously taking notes.
For the second, dude, the ISPs are listening, dude. What I had thought about was basically maybe there's a limited feature set and then expand it, as in like the expanded could be sharing on exporting or sharing with other people, exporting certain ways, syncing to services like Readwise or Obsidian or Roam, or I mean Obsidian probably first, to be honest.
Obviously, don't even ship anything else.
Honestly, that will probably be what the extent of this is. I will make my system work and that'll just be it.
You do that, you start using it and you find value in it, then you can explore those other things. Oh, maybe I could sell this, or maybe I could just let my friends use it and they like it.
Yeah.
Talking about failing building products, that's going to be on my tombstone. Lived X number of years, failed 200 products. And the thing that bugs me the most about it isn't necessarily the like, oh, I'm not making money from it. It's like, I just want to build stuff that people use and find value in, which I do at Podia. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I think that's what's hard about failing products. Like, my dream is to one day like do my own thing, but really I just want people to find joy or make their life a little better. So if it makes your life better, surely it'll make someone else's life better. And then if it does, then you can.
That's the only reason I like programming, is seeing people use stuff that I made and know that I hopefully save them time and money and whatever else. When I was in high school, that was my first taste of Linux, and using Ubuntu on my laptop was kind of just wild, because you go from like using Windows and everything is a black box, and then you go to Linux and like, there's forums with thousands of people asking questions about how do I run it on my laptop and whatever. And I just started talking to these people, trying to get stuff to work. And then I found this kid that was in college making like some configuration tool to install like the NVIDIA driver back when it was really a pain in the butt to install. And I was like, I want to be that guy someday, just building stuff for the community and making people's lives easier. And that's where I like got started. I was like, I want to give back to the community because it's so awesome. The amount of stuff that people have done for free. And I really, really liked hearing from people using, like somebody in the government used my first app to install packages offline. And I was like, I never would have dreamed that they used it on some super secure server that wasn't allowed internet access. And then somebody else emailed me from South Africa and was like, hey, we don't have reliable power here, so we don't have internet. You didn't know it, but you helped set up a whole computer system for this school. And I was like, this is crazy. So those were addicting emails to get from people. And then you're like, yeah, I got to keep doing this. And I just want to do more. It was cool.
Big feel energy right there.
It ended up in a magazine, Linux Journal magazine. I forget what month, what year it was, but
it's been published.
My mom has several copies of that magazine saved somewhere. Not Power Rangers, not near as cool, but, you know.
Me and my mom are in a little bit of a feud right now because there's this bitch
Family picture. Feud?
Yeah, we're on Family Feud with Steve Harvey right now because there's this picture of me with Lee Greenwood when I was 4 in a little tuxedo. Lee Greenwood's the guy that sings God Bless the USA. She can't find it. And I'm like, I'm upset. Back to what you were actually talking about. On a different level, that's why I liked working at Lens Rentals so much, which was my last job, because most of the tooling that we built was internal. Like, I worked on the customer facing site quite a bit, but most of the applications we built day to day were for the 100 and whatever people working in the office. And I would, whether I wanted to or not, hear their things that were bothering them. But also I got to also build things that like helped make their lives better, including one of which was my wife, who also worked at Lens Rentals. That was cool. Now I get to do that on a bigger level at Podia, but
you probably have a little bit less interaction with the users. Right.
The company does a really good job of like helping us kind of keep a pulse on what creators are needing and wanting. But it is something about being in the office with the people at Lens Rentals every day that was like, oh, it's very clear.
They get to stop by and tell you thank you or whatever. Like, you talk to them directly and it's not just an email or whatever.
Or it's like, what the hell have you done? This is terrible.
I know.
Jason, you broke.
I'm going to prank you one day.
I can't wait.
Knock on your door and be like, dude, what did you do?
Dude, that would be the best prank ever.
Yeah, it would be great, especially if I also like paused the app for a minute while that happened.
Yeah, and then stayed with us for a week.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could like hop on his network and then take the site down local on the network. Then be like, Jason, you took down Podia.
Sneak 100.
I would love that. We don't have a guest room right now, but you can sleep in our minivan. It's got power.
I've slept in many a minivan.
Doesn't it also have Wi-Fi?
It does.
It has Wi-Fi?
You don't need anything else.
Yeah.
Stop looking for houses. I'm how much you want for it?
When they sold us the car, I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. It has Wi-Fi. Like, I'm never going to pay for that. And then Shannon was leaving for the beach with the boys one day and was like, hey, it's a 6-hour drive. I really want them to have internet. And it was cheaper to buy it for the year. And now I'm stuck in it because my kids are spoiled rotten and have internet in the freaking car.
Honestly, they sound like they're balling. So congrats.
They are ballers.
Kids in school.
They're ballers.
Do you think the Power Rangers would survive without internet? Come on.
That's true.
No way.
Going back real fast to the like staying in touch with the users. I kind of remember like doing support rotations as developers at Podia. Yep. Does that still go on?
Yep. Andrew and I are on one next week with Seb. So
nice.
Good to know.
I think that's a great way to have people like as developers. You can definitely, I mean, if you're working at Google, they don't even really have support teams that actually you can get a hold of anyway sometimes. So like those developers are so far away from the users. You can definitely see that that doesn't add up a lot of times, but if you are building a customer focused company like that, you absolutely want those people to overlap.
Yeah. So we had our retreat when this airs, it'd be 2 weeks ago, and we had an all hands meeting. It was like 10, 20 minutes the first day. We were just talking about some stuff going on in the company, kind of like the future, stuff like that. And one of our support people raised a question that was so empathetic of the creator view of things. It was like, that's what I want. Courtney is thinking on a really just amazing level. And so shout out Courtney, who will never listen to this podcast, but
she will when I send her the highlight of you saying that. Bet.
See, I was biting my tongue.
No, I'll say it. I'm going down with the ship now.
I was betting my tongue.
Oh my God. That was one for sure.
I'm working on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as a final to my possible product building journey, here's my final question. For me to actually like get the most value out of it and for it to be like most helpful, there's got to be some form of iOS version. So do I dabble in Swift or do I upgrade my Jumpstart Pro subscription to get the iOS stuff?
The nice part is like the iOS Jumpstart version would already work with Jumpstart, the Rails app. So like you would get the whole thing on the web embedded remotely or responsively into the app also remotely.
Did you say responsively or responsibly?
Both. I mean, why not?
I heard responsibly.
Yeah.
We're getting a lot of value here is what we're saying.
I think the hard part about building anything like that for writing notes is going to be like, okay, you would need some sort of share from the YouTube app and then embed it and have a player version. And so maybe that's the easier thing to start building. And having all those ideas of what eventually you want to do ahead of time so you can like design for that change in the future will save you a ton of time on your building your product. Because if you can envision that direction for the next 5 years, then you can definitely spend time on like, let's not waste 3 months building some browser extension. Let's just copy the dang URL and put it in here. And we could be like ready to go tomorrow because we can use the like iframe or JS API to interact with it. And that could even work on mobile too, embedded in your Hotwire Jumpstart iOS app or whatever. So those are probably the biggest decisions I would figure out is don't worry about charging for it at day one, but think about how you can charge for it and how you would want it to work and what you would charge for and whatever. Don't worry about it. Build it with at least the like teams and stuff in mind. And then you can add payments and stuff later. Get something free that you can get your friends using with you so that they can give you feedback on it. Use it every day yourself so you can figure out all those rough edges that are like, oh, I wish I didn't have to click these four buttons to get this place. And I wish I had a command palette to jump straight there. Then like, okay, now you're talking. You're starting to figure out the ways and solutions that you could give to other people because you're kind of going from this spectrum of I need something that just functions, period, to something that like functions well enough that my friends can use it to eventually like quality enough that it's worth paying for. And it's like phases that you're just working through. That's what we did for pretty much everything I built. Patchbox is a good example. Like it was a tutorial on Go Rails for the longest time. Then package it up and deploy to a single server. That's cool. But eventually it was like, okay, the real production version of this is it's got to deploy to multiple servers and handle all this extra stuff, maybe other programming languages and whatever. So it's always like these phases. And if you can break it down into those chunks, I think that'll really help you like plan it out. And then thinking about, like you said, if I know that I need a mobile version of this, how does that work? And let's think about that maybe first. And if you can make that work really well, then the web version should be easier or whatever. So
pro tip, build it with PhoneGap.
Cordova.
Apache Cordova.
I have no idea what that is. I've never heard that word before.
It's some boomer tech from the early 2010s, late 2000s.
2010s, dude. I wasn't even in high school.
Okay, so it's basically like JS APIs to access native features. It's the precursor to, there's another popular one I used to use that does the same thing. Ionic. It's like the precursor to Ionic.
I have looked at Ionic.
Yeah, I think you'd be in good hands using Jumpstart.
2010.
I'm more
2010 technology.
I more or less just want to shout out PhoneGap in 2022 like a badass. So,
all right. Well, I have my movement plan. I'm going to go upgrade my Jumpstart package and then I'm going to start planning.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Don't forget to use the referral code remote room.
Oh, yeah.
I've been like deep in the weeds on refactoring all this Stripe checkout stuff for Jumpstart lately. And
we lost Andrew.
Oh my gosh. I just am frustrated that their Stripe checkout page works so flawlessly, but their JavaScript doesn't allow me to do the exact same thing.
It is probably designed that way.
I mean, they want that to be the best integration. So now I'm like, do we just redirect to Stripe checkout for everything? And it's maybe not the worst option. So
I got to a point when I was building a lot of SaaS apps, that's all I did was, oh, you don't even have a customer portal. It's just a Stripe, the hosted Stripe customer dashboard.
Yeah, yeah.
It made my code so much simpler, but I wasn't using Jumpstart or anything like that. So that would have been handled for me.
Well, that's
otherwise.
That's the thing is, like, I want to make the white labeled version for you that feels super clean and super native. But at the moment, their payment element JavaScript is not quite up to speed to support tax and other things like promo codes. You have to go through this crazy little cycle right now where if you want to do taxes, you have to collect the billing address up front and a potential promo code. And then you can create a subscription that's incomplete in order to get the secret for the JavaScript to render the payment element. But somehow Stripe Checkout does that all on a single page. Mm. And if you were to go and do kind of what they do, you would have to effectively like just continue creating new subscriptions anytime the tax address or the promo code change, and just like reload the payment element itself each time with a new secret. And I was like, this seems a little unfinished. So we're like right now, like fixing and doing, we've got a ton of stuff queued up for pay version 4, which won't be a hard upgrade like the last one was, because the last one was a lot of database migrations. This one's like just new features for the most part and a couple breaking changes to kind of support metered billing and line items and whatnot. But the client side is still rough on their end. It's not our fault, unfortunately, but hoping that stuff comes soon.
We've been exploring the new payment element at Podia because we in checkout still use payment elements. That wasn't a confusing change. And the new payment element is badass because it's like you don't have to worry about adding manual support for things other than cards like Apple Pay or Ideal. And the thing that's really awesome, we've talked about this, I think, a few episodes ago. So Stripe used to be tokens and charges, and life was so simple. I think that's part of a big reason why Stripe was, I mean, they made a clean API for it. It's part of the reason they excelled. And then there was a change to payment intents, which was, okay, you have an intent to pay because there's a thing with strong customer authentication in the EU where we can put in your card, but we got to authenticate it. So it's like with payment intents now awaiting authentication. And then to say that it's good, we'll confirm it. And that created a lot of back and forth for us between the client and the server, because it was like, okay, customer enters their card information. Stripe gives us a token. We send that token to the server. We basically create a payment intent. If it's good, we can go ahead and finish the order. Otherwise, it's in this pending state awaiting authentication. We have to go back to the client. Client has to do some stuff. Then we have to go back to the server with another roundabout. It just created a lot of opportunities for things to go wrong. There were just a lot of edge cases.
Right.
There. And so with this new payment element, it's awesome because all of that happens on the client. Like you were saying, though, the only way for that to happen is if you've created a payment intent when the client loads. So we too have this where tax is fluid, coupon codes are fluid. And so what we're doing is when one of those values changes, we go back to the server with an AJAX request and just update the payment intent. But we actually don't have to update the client, because we're using the same payment intent. So in theory, and like our payment intent doesn't show pricing or anything, right? It's just about taking the card information. So then as long as that server has updated the payment intent before the user clicks submit, which we would, you know, make sure you couldn't submit without it updating, then everything should just work. And this is something we're still experimenting with, but I think that's going to be a pretty big win for us in terms of complexity. There's still a little bit of thinking and edge casing here, but the fact that the client handles 90% of it is worth me or Seb or Andrew having to spend a little time working this kind of ping pong environment towards the end.
Yeah, because my process has been like, when the page loads, we create the subscription in a pending state, their incomplete state, and then we grab the latest invoice and client secret and use that in the view. But then I guess like we could manually update that payment intent, but it's not going to, the invoice is like finalized, which means your billing address and your promo code wouldn't be applied to that invoice. But it's the first invoice for the subscription. And I was like, it would be really nice. It'd be the nicest thing if you could, in the browser, say, here's the customer's address, go update them and resend me the invoice on the client side or something, and do the same kind of thing from the promo code and Stripe Tax perspective. Because that was the issue that I ran into, is like the invoice is finalized, so it doesn't get updated correctly for discounts or
tax. We're at least not finalized yet, because we're talking about one-time purchases. So like we're still on the that process. Yeah.
Yeah. Since we're doing the subscription, and that pushed me almost for a moment to be like, what if we just like don't use Stripe billing and you could do a cron job to like bill every month or whatever, but you don't really want to go down that route. It's not super fun. I've done that before. And yeah. So I don't know. There's some work to be done around that. I know that they're working on it. They're aware of it. It's definitely not, from what I could tell, like there wasn't a way, like it'd be actually totally fine if I could seamlessly swap out the payment intent on the client side, but it becomes a problem if the customer puts in their credit card and it attaches to the payment intent and we don't confirm it and they go and add a promo code just before they click submit, then it would like create a new payment intent probably with the card not attached to it. And they'd have to re-enter their information and stuff. So it is not possible at the moment to kind of build that like super slick checkout, at least with subscriptions from what I can tell, as they have on their site and like what you guys are able to do. But yeah, that fluidity of the billing address and promo codes and any other possible changes before the last second of submission is kind of a pain.
I'd like to build the slick Stripe checkout experience with the Stripe tooling, maybe one day.
Yeah.
Also, while we're talking about Stripe, and I know we're like 100 minutes over, Stripe does crypto payouts as of today. Is that right?
Yeah, saw that. Remember they had pay with Bitcoin back in like 2015 or something? It was a long time ago.
Right?
Yeah.
They pulled it for some reason. I feel like maybe there was like the government was part of that or something. I don't know. I'm just spreading rumors now.
That's all we do here on Remote Ruby.
Remote rumors.
I really like the idea of using payment element though, because for like Jumpstart, I don't know where everybody is around the world, like customers are all over the world. So right now we just have a card form. And so I was like so excited to upgrade to a payment element. And the JavaScript side of things just became so simple. It was like, hey, you gave me a client secret. I'll use it. We'll display it. We're good to go. Nothing about the flows of, are you adding a new card? Do we just tokenize it? Or are you subscribing? Do we like send that in a form to the back end to be created, you know, and whatever else. So we had a lot of simplification on our JavaScript side, switching to the payment element, but the whole rest of the flow became kind of a pain, but we're really close. And I know that like, it may not be perfect right now. So we may just end up merging it and shipping it and using it. And then as they add, like, I'm assuming there will be like a billing address element type of thing, or hopefully it's just a checkout element. That's like, here's all of the checkout stuff. Drop it on your page and then you would just have that instead of the payment element, which would be a combo of everything.
So the payment element is interesting because it can take addresses, but you can't require it to. You can tell it to automatically figure out when it should prompt for address or to never prompt for address.
Hmm.
And so that's frustrating because...
Is it because there's like three different addresses too? There's like the address on your payment method, and then there's the customer's billing address and the customer's shipping address. And I was never quite sure. I don't think Which address was it recording?
I assume it to be billing address. If I use the Podia credit card, I'm going to use the Podia address, which is just 123 remote. But that requires us to then take in our own billing fields, send them to Stripe with, like, we have to tell Stripe, never render billing fields. Like, if we're trying to calculate tax, right? Never render billing. We'll just create our own form inputs.
Yep. That's what we're doing.
Send them to you. I think it, like,
so I intercepted the flow right now where you click on the pricing page, you choose your plan. We go take you to subscriptions new and whatever plan. And then if that, we look up the plan, if the plan requires tax, then we will check to see if you have a billing address. If you don't have one, we'll take you to like a billing address route and display that form. Then you click continue and it takes you back to the page you were just on, so that the subscriptions new page is still the final checkout page. But we kind of have like a optional wizard step in there for collecting a billing address. And then we'll like display it on the final page. And you can do like the Shopify version where you still see a snippet of it and you can hit edit and it will take you back to that step. Same thing here. Like, we just take you to that route. And, you know, we'd be able to introduce a shipping address really easily into that as well and have it work the same way. So it ends up being kind of a wizard thing. And then I've been doing it without turbo frames, but we can just slap a turbo frame on it and it'll be all seamless internal to that. But also, like, I'd love to do the summary of what you're paying for today as well. So the idea of like the first time you visit the page, tax is like a question mark. And then you put in your billing address. Then we can create a new subscription that will give us the actual tax amount, and then we can display it on the page. So it's one of those where, like, I'd love to do as much of this stuff server side, and we've got it really good right now where the JavaScript for the payment element is just very minimal and that's it. So it cleaned up a lot there, but it's just a matter of like promo codes and modifying that stuff requiring a whole new subscription. We can kind of effectively edit those things and then refresh the page and it will do that right now. And that works great, but I would probably rather have it all live kind of updating instead of refreshing the page. So maybe we'll do that one day, but we'll see what Stripe comes out with. But I swear the payments went from being so simple to SCA and nobody has good solutions.
I do. And I still, speaking of products I want to launch, it's pay by mail, SaaS payments by mail.
We trust in that old postal system, huh?
That's it. It's nothing more reliable in the United States than the United States Postal Service.
You're really bringing me back to my grade school days. My parents would take me to the bookstore, and this is back when there were these things called floppy disks. Andrew probably hasn't heard of them, but we would go grab a bunch of shareware demos for like $1.50 or something. And then I'd have all these games where I could play a little bit of them. Every single time, the last part of the game is like, look at all these cool extras and episodes and whatever else. If you just mail us $60 to this random address, it was like, never could convince my parents to send a random stranger a check like that.
I didn't need the library. AOL sent me that free in the mail.
Yeah. I don't think we ever had, maybe we did have AOL at some point. We had like Juno and some other terrible dial-up.
We had AOL. I remember it. We had the family computer. And I remember how mind-boggling it was when we got Roadrunner, which Roadrunner, through a long series of events, became Xfinity.
I'm so excited. We'll have CenturyLink out at where we're building the house. And I went on there because we're probably about a month away from moving in, or the house being kind of finished and then moving. The builder actually scheduled the cleaning tentatively for May 25th. And I was like, hey, what a good birthday present.
Happy birthday to you.
I'm on Spectrum right now. I pay like $90 a month for 400 megs and like 30 up, which sucks for uploading screencasts. And we're going to have like a gig symmetric at the new house. And I'm like so excited for it. So I can't wait. You'll be seeing me just publishing. Maybe I'll just like live stream 24/7 just because I can.
Bet.
It'll just be like me angry all the time. These stupid APIs.
Yeah.
So me, basically.
Yeah, that's the stuff behind the screencast is just like lots of anger. Like I can't anything ever work.
It's our own version of VH1 behind the music. Do you know what VH1 is, Andrew?
Like a VHS? No.
VH1 was...
VCR?
Was the tamer MTV, but it had a bunch of... Maybe like the more versatile MTV. And it had this series called Behind the Music. And it was basically a look at like a bunch of bands dating back to like the 60s, the 80s, 90s.
I didn't have cable growing up. So I had channel...
Yeah, me either.
2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, sometimes 8. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you have channel 1 in school?
I was homeschooled for the majority of school.
Chris, channel 1?
I don't know.
So I homeschooled in high school. When I was in middle school, there was this thing we watched in like social studies called Channel 1. And it was like basically like a teen news and social events thing. A lot of schools had it, but apparently not. If you know what Channel 1 is and you're listening to this, please tweet me so I don't feel like an idiot.
Or VH1.
Yeah, or tweet Andrew if you don't know what VH1 is either. Andrew is inbox 0, so email Andrew all you want.
No, don't tell people that. Then anyone I didn't respond to knows I just put that in the trash.
What if we just mail him letters?
I'm not going to be at this house much longer, so...
Well, then how am I going to come and stay with you?
Like, I move in June 20th.
Oh, you know, you'll still be there. I want to believe that the Grizzlies can make it that far, but I really don't believe it.
I mean, lost to the Pelicans, so I'm losing hope too.
This won't be a basketball podcast much longer, but I heard that the ref who ref that game you lost to, Chris Paul, is like 0-12 when he refs games.
I mean, if it walks and it talks.
Duck typing.
Yep, it might be a duck.
Quack, quack. See you next week.
Bye.
Later.